Welcome to the Shortwave Report for November 25th, 2011. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past four shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK World Radio Japan, China Radio International, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, Radio Havana Cuba, and The Voice of Russia. We'll begin with NHK World Radio Japan. The Grand Assembly of Traditional Afghanistan has voted to allow U.S. troops to remain in the country until 2024. A Japanese government panel is considering resuming the construction of a fast-breed nuclear reactor. NHK Japan.
The Taliban has condemned a decision by Afghanistan's traditional Grand Assembly to allow U.S. troops to stay in the country until 2024, 10 years beyond a planned transfer of authority. The assembly of more than 2,000 tribal elders and dignitaries, known as Loye Jirga, agreed to the extension at its session that ended on Saturday. But this was on condition that U.S. troops stop conducting nighttime raids. In a statement on Sunday, the Taliban said the assembly members are not the true representatives of Afghanistan. The Taliban repeated its position that the only solution is for international forces to leave Afghanistan. It vowed to continue its fight until all foreign troops are withdrawn. In the eastern city of Jalalabad, about 1,000 students took to the streets in protest against the decision. Public opinion is divided among Afghans. Some are concerned that the country's military and police are not capable of maintaining law and order by themselves, while others oppose the U.S. military presence. A Japanese government panel says a project to build an experimental fast-breeder nuclear reactor should be thoroughly reviewed before a decision is made on its future. The seven-member panel focused on the country's nuclear projects on Sunday, the first day of its four-day policy screening. Some panel members said it would be difficult to gain public understanding for the resumption of the Monju project. They added that it is not clear if the reactor can be put into commercial service by 2050 as originally planned. The Monju reactor uses plutonium extracted from spent nuclear fuel to generate power and has been regarded as a prototype for Japan's next-generation nuclear plant. The panel concluded that a budget of $29 million for next summer's test run of the Monju project should be cut along with various maintenance costs except for the crucial portion. It also questioned an allocation of $292 million for an international nuclear fusion project, as the amount is about five times the total for the current fiscal year. Some panel members said the funds should be used to rebuild the area around the Fukushima plant by decontaminating soil and installing radiation monitoring systems. The panel concluded that Japan should try to reduce the financial burden of the project by negotiating its suspension or cancellation with the other six participating countries. The science ministry says it will consider the next step after seeing the results of the discussion by a panel of cabinet members on the country's nuclear policies, including the fast-breeder reactor project.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 9 to 9:30 p.m. at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, China Radio International. A review of the current nuclear power plant policies in European nations. The British Medical Association has recommended that smoking while driving should be banned in the UK. China Radio International.
Following the Fukushima disaster in March, caused by an earthquake and a tsunami, many European countries put their nuclear power plants on hold or under review, and some, including Germany, Italy, and Switzerland, have opted out of the technology entirely. Germany has declared it wants to shut all nuclear reactors by 2022. Italy, the only non-nuclear G8 industrialized nation, has shelved plans to build new plants, and Belgium, too, has decided to shut down the country's two remaining nuclear power stations. At the same time, the position of some other European countries, including the Czech Republic and Finland, contrasts sharply with Germany. Finland is building a new reactor. It's the country's fifth and first nuclear reactor site to be announced since the Fukushima disaster. Colette Lewiner is the top energy, utilities and chemicals analyst at research group Capgemini based in Paris.
If you look at the majority of the countries, they have decided to go further with nuclear. Nuclear is a good option. It is competitive. It is clean in the sense it doesn't emit CO2. And when you have existing plants, to stop them, this is money you're going to throw out of the windows, as we say in French. So it's a political and it's a financial choice.
The winner says the energy future for Europe is likely to be a mixture of nuclear, gas, and energy from renewable sources.
Nuclear will stay. As we said, many countries decided to keep it as an option. Nevertheless, its market share will be lower than forecasted before Fukushima. We think that gas will increase its market share. That's what we say, what other institutes say as well, because gas is quite cheap to implement. It's quite cheap to implement a gas-fired plant. It is less polluting than coal, but it still emits CO2. And renewables should increase their market share as well, but they are today not competitive.
However, renewable energies have a higher production cost than nuclear power, so it may increase energy prices for European households, which make governments think about such choices. For CRI, I'm Su Yi.
One of these days, drivers in the UK could be breaking the law if the government heeds advice from the British Medical Association, or BMA, which suggests that the government ban people from smoking in their own vehicle. But because cars are private spaces, these proposals are proving contentious. One non-smoker says,
I have to ask her to open the window because I don't like it, as a non-smoker.
However, this woman does not believe the government should interfere.
I don't think the government have got any right to stop people smoking in their cars. I mean, it's not affecting anybody else outside. I mean, you've got diesel buses, you've got diesel cars that are making more pollution than me smoking in my car.
It's a sentiment shared by this man.
If it's my body, though, it's my decision. That's about it. That's what it comes down to, isn't it?
Children are believed to be at the highest risk of these circumstances. In an experiment, a man is smoking in his car to test the levels of harmful toxins in the smoke. Dr. James Kent from the British Lung Foundation explains the findings.
What we started with before the cigarette was lit was a relatively normal level of about 12. Once we get beyond 35, it starts to become dangerous to human health. What we saw once the cigarette was lit, within a few seconds, the meter readings actually shot up into the hundreds and stayed there for some time after the cigarette was extinguished.
The document also says the elderly are vulnerable to respiratory problems caused by passive smoking. Dr. Vivian Nathan, the BMA's Director of Professional Activity, says smoking causes over 80,000 deaths every year in England. Last week, Northern Ireland's Health Minister Edwin Pooch says he's considering a ban on smoking in cars, and a private member's bill in the UK is calling for a ban. But any legislation will be bitterly opposed by the smokers' rights group, Forest. Simon Clark of Forest says,
you might have a single lone adult behind the wheel, chooses to light a cigarette, suddenly he'll be committing an offence. The police will be expected to pull him over, no doubt give him penalty points, fine him. If he doesn't pay the fine, he could end up in jail, for heaven's sake. It's utterly ridiculous. A car is a private space.
If the bill gets passed, smokers in the UK could soon be puffing on their last cigarette in their own car if doctors get their way. For CRI, I'm Li Dong.
Those reports were from China Radio International, heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 11970, and from 6 p.m. to 11 at either 9790, 6020, or 6190, or on the web at english.cri.cn. On to Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. There was a week-long debate at the United Nations on cluster bombs. Most countries want complete abolition, but the United States, Russia, and China want old stockpiles reduced while continuing new production. The United Nations released new figures on the prevalence and growth of HIV/AIDS in the world. Russia has called new sanctions against Iran unacceptable and against international law. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
All week long, negotiations have been underway at the United Nations in Geneva on a new protocol designed, its supporters say, to limit the use of cluster bombs. A convention to ban the production, transfer and use of cluster munitions already exists. The Oslo Convention came into force last year and has been signed by 111 countries. But it does not have the support of nations which produce cluster weapons, among them the United States, Russia and China. Their governments say the new protocol would at least introduce some controls, but disarmament groups say the new proposals are weak and will undermine the existing ban. Imogen Foltz reports from Geneva.
Cluster weapons. One bomb that turns into hundreds of little bombs, which themselves rain lethal shrapnel for miles around. For years, human rights groups have argued that such a weapon should be banned because they claim it is indiscriminate, its explosive power so widespread that no one using it can guarantee civilians be spared. In recent years, the campaign to ban clusters has gathered pace. 111 countries are now committed under the Oslo Convention to banning cluster bombs completely. But that sounds more promising than it actually is, because the countries which produce 85% of all cluster munitions, the US, Russia and China, have not signed Oslo and say they are never likely to do so. But they have come to Geneva with a proposal. They are ready to introduce some controls, such as banning all cluster weapons produced before 1980, a move Philip Spector, head of the US delegation, says would lead to a major reduction in global stockpiles.
The ban on cluster munitions produced before 1980 would immediately prohibit over 2 million cluster munitions, representing more than 100 million submunitions. In other words, the pre-1980 rule alone will prohibit more cluster munitions for the United States than the Oslo Convention has prohibited for all of its member states combined.
It all sounds very positive. Strangely, then, human rights groups are not impressed. Steve Goose of Human Rights Watch.
It's an awkward position to be in. Usually, NGOs are pushing to create new international law that offers stronger protection to civilians. But in this case, we already have a really good law, the Convention on Cluster Munitions, that comprehensively bans the weapon. And what we're seeing here, very regrettably, is the development of an alternative, a kind of backdoor maneuver by the United States and others to create a very weak permissive law that, in fact, would allow them to use most of the cluster munitions in existence today.
My son was killed while clearing cluster munitions.
So as the controversy heats up, the lobbying in Geneva has become intense. Victims of cluster weapons, like Lynn Braddock, have powerful arguments.
He was a U.S. Marine, and he'd been trained to clear munitions and clear unexploded ordnance. And I can't even tell you how upset I was, how frightened I was, how so many things that he promised he'd be safe. So I believed him. But he was the only one who didn't come home.
Lynn's son was killed by a U.S. cluster bomb left behind in Iraq. She doesn't welcome the US proposal on eliminating just some weapons. She wants them all banned, a sentiment echoed by the neutral International Committee of the Red Cross. The organisation's weapons specialist, Peter Hirby, says introducing new regulations which are far weaker than the existing convention would set a dangerous precedent in international humanitarian law.
If we had a human rights convention that banned torture, and then a group of countries couldn't go that far and they wanted to allow certain types of torture and to negotiate a treaty that would allow that, it would be pretty shocking. And indeed, we have a proposal that would allow the use of certain kinds of cluster munitions, some of them for the next 15, 20 years. We would like to see a progressive step by these countries who can't yet sign the Convention on Cluster Munitions towards a complete prohibition, not towards a permanent legitimization of some or all types of cluster munitions.
For its part, the United States seems taken aback by the strength of the opposition. Its proposals are backed by the Obama administration because, says Philip Spector, they are viewed as the last best chance to get the world's chief users and producers of cluster munitions to introduce some controls.
After so many years of negotiations, a protocol that would bring major users and producers of cluster munitions under a binding legal regime for the first time is finally within reach. We must not let this rare and unique opportunity slip away. We must act now to realize this humanitarian aim.
But once again, those who have suffered the effects of cluster weapons like Lynn Braddock are simply not convinced. For her, the only solution is a total ban, like the one the 111 signatories to the Oslo Convention have already adopted.
No, I'm sorry. You have to stop. You have to say no, and that's why I'm fighting against no more protocols. This is it. This is the standard. I hope my country one day wants to meet that standard. I don't want the rest of the world coming down to the standard they've decided to set.
And so the negotiations continue. Countries which had originally said they might support the US proposals, like Britain and Germany, now say they are too weak. They want changes before they will back them. Meanwhile, Russia and China have quietly indicated they are unlikely to make further concessions because they believe the proposals go far enough. As so often with disarmament talks, long days and nights of negotiation lie ahead. Imogen Folks, Deutsche Welle Radio, Geneva.
New UN figures released ahead of World HIV/AIDS Day show that 2.67 million people contracted the virus last year. But that is 21% fewer than at the epidemic's high point in 1997. UNAIDS Director Michel Sidibe described 2010 as a game-changing year, but also warned the epidemic was not beaten. The total number of people living with the virus has reached a record high of roughly 34 million people worldwide, but the UN said this is testament to improved life-prolonging medical care for sufferers. The UN estimates that half of the people eligible for treatment worldwide now receive it.
Russia has called new sanctions against Iran unacceptable, a day after the United States announced tougher measures against the regime. Russia's foreign ministry issued a statement on Tuesday calling such measures unacceptable and also against international law. On Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that the measures target Iran's petrochemical industry as well as its oil and gas business. The UN's nuclear watchdog, meanwhile, has said that it has reason to believe that Tehran is trying to build a nuclear weapon. The government in Tehran contests this and says that its nuclear ambitions are only to produce nuclear energy.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which has just dropped its excellent radio podcast Newslink in favor of a combined audio-video website that may be found at mediacenter.dw-world.de. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. There will be a conference next week in Washington, D.C., calling for the removal of Cuba from the list of states that sponsor terrorism. Ecuador is creating a joint proposal calling for the democratization of the United Nations. Radio Havana, Cuba.
A conference calling for Cuba's removal from the list of state sponsors of terrorism is to be held next Thursday, December the 1st, in Washington, D.C., online sources reported. The meeting, organized by the Latin America Working Group and the Center for International Policy, will take place at the Zinger Room of the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. The meeting's convocation notice stated that one of the most cynical aspects of the U.S. policy toward Cuba is keeping it on the list of state sponsors of terrorism because there is no evidence that would place it there. During the gathering, a panel of prominent speakers will explain the lack of proof that the United States has to keep Cuba on such a list, as well as the interference of this policy with the goal of both populations to normalize bilateral relations. The Ecuadorian government is contacting several countries to put forward a joint proposal to democratize the United Nations system. Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa told reporters in Quito, "We will come together with other nations in the world to approve a joint proposal on this matter. We know we are not alone." He also called for regional integration to change that relation of power. Correa also noted that the UN Security Council is an absolutely anti-democratic body, including a handful of nations with veto power, which proclaim themselves as the world's gendarmes and referees. The president also criticized the Inter-American system of the Organization of American States, noting that it is a contradiction that the OAS is headquartered in Washington when the United States does not recognize the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. In addition, President Correa said he hopes that the community of Latin American and Caribbean states, to be established in Venezuela on December the 2nd and the 3rd, replaces the OAS.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 2 p.m. to 3 at 11760, and from 4 to 10 p.m. at either 6060, 6010, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 4 to 10 p.m. at www.radiohc.cu. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production costs of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please help if you can, like a listener in Ukiah, California did this week. We will conclude with the voice of Russia. A commentary on a United Nations-sponsored forum held to discuss methods of turning the Middle East into a nuclear-free zone. Russia strongly condemned the sanctions that the U.S. has placed against Iran. The voice of Russia.
Last week, over 100 nations attended a forum in Vienna, Austria, to discuss possible methods of turning the Middle East into a nuclear-free zone. Supervised by the United Nations, the focus of the meeting was on the relationship between Israel and the Arab states, and it was viewed as a means to bring the two sides together in an atmosphere of open, honest exchange. The biggest news coming out of the forum ended up being about the U.S. and Russia, which joined together on one front while differing bitterly on another.
On one hand, Russia joined the U.S. and the U.K. in support of Israel's view that the way to move towards a nuclear-free Middle East is to focus on regional peacemaking efforts. At the same time, the three nations refused Arab offers to help create such a zone. The joint statement said, "Zones free of nuclear weapons cannot be created counter to the will of the countries of the region by the efforts of extra-regional powers or international organizations."
On the other hand, Russia issued a strong statement condemning new financial and energy sanctions that the U.S. has placed on Iran. Moscow said that the sanctions would have the opposite of the intended effect, likely pushing Tehran into a corner and making further negotiations over the nation's nuclear program nearly impossible. In an official statement, Russian Foreign Ministry spokesman Alexander Lukashevich said, "We again underline that the Russian Federation considers such extraterritorial measures unacceptable and contradictory to international law."
Iran boycotted the meeting, which took place under the aegis of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, which only 2 weeks ago published a report claiming that Iran was much closer to developing nuclear weapons materials than had previously been believed. Ali Akbar Salehi, Iran's foreign minister and a former top nuclear official in the country, told the Iranian Mehr news agency that the controversy over the country's nuclear program is 100% political, and he said that the UN's nuclear watchdog is under pressure from foreign powers.
The UN Security Council already has sanctions in place against Iran for its nuclear program, and Russia has supported four previous series of sanctions against the country since 2006. Just last year, Moscow sided with Washington not only on the issue of sanctions, but also by agreeing not to follow through on a plan to sell Iran ground-to-air missiles. However, Moscow has also consistently opposed the placement of further sanctions outside of those endorsed by the Council, where, as a permanent member, Moscow has the power to veto any proposals it doesn't agree with.
Despite the strong disagreement over sanctions on Iran, Moscow did offer a surprising sign of support to Israel, agreeing with the country's assessment that regional peace must come before nuclear disarmament. Touching on this issue, the statement said, "While nuclear weapon-free zones improve the security of the entire international community, they do not exist in isolation from other security factors." It added that before progress can be made on such a zone, the countries in the region must be united in their aspiration to provide for strengthened regional stability and security.
The Arabs have historically insisted that the two issues are linked, claiming that Israel's stockpile of nuclear weapons, albeit undeclared, is a constant threat to other countries in the region and therefore the biggest obstacle to peace. Last weekend's forum didn't come anywhere close to changing that view, though Arab nations still appeared pleased with the meeting. For years, the Arab nations have pursued a set of demands from Israel, which includes acknowledging that it has nuclear weapons, joining the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and allowing UN inspectors to examine the nation's nuclear activities.
Tuesday night in the U.S., Republicans gathered for a presidential candidate debate, and the issue of Iran dominated the proceedings. Illustrating the lack of agreement on how best to address the issue, the presidential hopefuls sparred over the effectiveness of sanctions and the dangers inherent in a military attack on the country.
While most of the candidates at Tuesday's presidential debate offered varying degrees of support for Israel and the ongoing tensions between the two countries, Senator Ron Paul stood out for his opposing view. When Paul was asked if, as president, he would support an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, the senator asked, "Why does Israel need our help?" Later, the congressman added, "We interfere with them when they deal with their borders. When they want to have peace treaties, we tell them what they can do, because we buy their allegiance and they sacrifice their sovereignty to us. And then they decide they want to bomb something? That's their business, but they should, you know, suffer the consequences."
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 10 at 12030 13665 9840 and 7250, or through their website www.english.ruvr.ru. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcast using a shortwave radio at home, which is far simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.